from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. 45 years ago, Tony and Maureen Wheeler traveled overland from London to Sydney, Australia, with just a few dollars in their pocket, a trip that became the basis of their first Lonely Planet guidebook, Across Asia on the Cheap. By 2010, Lonely Planet had printed 100 million travel guides to destinations across the world. Coming up on Forum, Tony Wheeler joins us in the studio to talk about his remarkable journey and to take your travel questions, and that's coming up next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When Maureen and Tony Wheeler published their first Lonely Planet travel book back in 1973, they just completed a six-month trip across Asia that left them with all of 27 cents between them. Since then, Lonely Planet has expanded to become the largest travel guide company in the world, helping backpackers and economy travelers visit far-flung places in India, China, Afghanistan, and beyond. Tony Wheeler joins us now here in studio to discuss how travel has changed since the company's early days, and we'll talk about the company and its history and his involvement with the Global Heritage Fund's sustainable tourism efforts. And Tony Wheeler, welcome back to Forum.
Thank you very much.
Always pleased to have you here. And let me go back to the story here, because it's a captivating story and a fascinating one. You get married in part to save taxes, I remember, right? And then you just head east, and you find yourself with the car broken down, and just kept going, taking notes and so forth and diary. That's really the genesis of Lonely Planet.
Yeah, we started out from London with a car that had cost us $150, thinking, you know, it's cheap enough that if it breaks down, we're just going to leave it, and drove it all the way to Afghanistan and sold it for a profit. So it was a good car.
And you took all these notes, stapled them together, got a printer, and went out hawking them.
That was really the start of Lonely Planet. We started it because the information that we'd gathered in our travels in Asia just wasn't generally available in those days, and we just didn't realize how much demand there was going to be for it.
So it's an accident.
It was essentially an accident. We didn't set off thinking we're going to become a guidebook publisher from this trip.
No, you'd set off on what they began to call a gap year, right? Which not too many people did in those days.
Yeah, that is definitely what you'd call it now. There were quite a lot of things. Looking back, we were traveling on the hippie trail, but it wasn't called the hippie trail at that time. It was called the Asia Overland Trip or something.
Yeah, and there was, in fact, a whole sense of your identification as hippies. It was even on your passport. How'd you get the name Lonely Planet?
You know, we finished our first book, and we were thinking, well, what do we call the publishing house that's going to put this book out? And we'd just been to see a film where rock and roll band on the road movie called Mad Dogs and Englishmen. Leon Russell and Joe Cocker, both of whom have died in the last couple of years. And there's one song in it which Joe Cocker sings, "Once while traveling across the sky, this lonely planet caught my eye." And I said to Maureen, "That sounds nice. Why don't we call it Lonely Planet?" And she replied, "Well, good idea, except actually he sings Lovely Planet." So the name was a mistake right from the start.
The name was a mistake. The first book was an accident. And then there was a book you were bootstrapping a long time, but 1981, the book on India, that was the breakthrough, yeah?
Yeah, the India Guide, when we did that, we'd been going for 5 years by that point. And that they were little books. They were 200, 300 pages. And back in those days, they were selling for $2.95, $3.95, that sort of price. And suddenly we had this book that was closer to 1,000 pages than 200 pages and sold for five times the price and sold five times as many copies. So it was just that one book made a big difference.
Well, the company did very well. By around 2000, I think it was worth $250 million when you sold it to the BBC for $270 million.
It's a good figure. I haven't heard that one.
Was it less? Was it more?
I have no idea.
It's been very remunerative. It's been a real success, entrepreneurial story, and congratulations on all that. But really, things hit a kind of hard spot after 9/11. I mean, in the travel industry in general.
Look, I think travel always has its ups and downs. And you know, 9/11 definitely was a difficult time for travel. But there were other times where people put the doors up and you know thought we're not going to get on the planes and not going to go. So, yeah, it's had its ups and downs. And 9/11 was certainly one of the biggest downs.
There's also a time that your business seemed to be maybe sinking.
Yeah, we had it. Like any business, you know, you find you've overextended at times. You've done too much of this and too much of that and had ideas that didn't always necessarily work.
And then I just want to follow the history of Lonely Planet a bit. We're on our own journey and odyssey here in terms of the company because a tobacco millionaire by the name of Brad Kelly wound up with some ownership after.
Yeah, well, we sold out about 10 years ago. Maureen and I were thinking, look, we're getting older. We want to be doing something different. And also the world was moving into digital travel. And although we, you know, we were interested in that and the company was doing a lot in that field, it wasn't our prime love. Maureen and I had always loved the books and paper and print. That was really our...
Still do, right?
Still do, yeah. Well, you know, these days I read far more guidebooks on a tablet than I do on paper.
But you spoke with some pride, I believe, recently about the fact that Lonely Planet, although it's... not your company anymore, still has not moved entirely into the digital realm.
Well, it's doing all the right things in digital, but I think that the print books are still very important.
And they're very popular. I'm sure we'll hear from listeners on that. You were speculating also that maybe China will wind up taking control of Lonely Planet eventually?
You know, I would not be surprised because China, the whole tourism thing in China is so big these days. And you know, every young Chinese, they want to have a car, they want to have an apartment, and they want to have an overseas trip. You know, overseas travel is really a thing that young Chinese aspire to. And Lonely Planet, they're all available in the Chinese language. There's a Lonely Planet office in Beijing, which I dropped in on earlier this year. And they sell a lot of Lonely Planet guidebooks.
So all these young, independent Chinese travelers buying a lot of Lonely Planet books. And I guess... when you were in China, it sounded like you were maybe describing San Francisco. We keep seeing building going on all the time around here, and that's what you saw everywhere in China?
Yeah, everywhere in China. I actually drove across China earlier this year. I drove in from Laos, and I drove out into Kazakhstan, so I went all the way across China. And it just seemed like you were in a construction zone the whole way. You'd be on a six-lane highway, and then off to one side, there's a high-speed railway line being built, and everywhere you look, there are wind turbines generating electricity. It's very scary in lots of ways, but it's also really invigorating and exciting what's going on there.
What kind of car were you driving?
I was driving an elderly MG. I joined a bunch of crazy Australians, and we shipped our MGs up to Bangkok, and then we spent 4 months driving from Bangkok to London.
Well, that hippie trail you took, that journey overland from London to Sydney, which is now a part of really the fame of the publishing company, doing it in reverse now?
That was doing it in reverse, yeah. And instead of the hippie trail, it was the Silk Road. So it was a little bit different route, but, you know, the same sort of spirit, I guess.
Well, went from Bangkok, actually. Right?
Yeah, well, this time we went from Bangkok. Last time we actually did go through Bangkok on the original trip, but of course you can't drive through Afghanistan anymore, and you don't really want to drive through Pakistan that much, but you can drive through China these days, which you couldn't do back in the 70s.
Our guest is Tony Wheeler. He's co-founder of the Lonely Planet Travel Guidebooks, a trustee with the Global Heritage Fund, which, by the way, aims to preserve archaeological sites around the world and is located here in the Bay Area. Talk about Global Heritage. I mean, why'd you get in it and what is it doing?
I've been with them for about 5 years. And while I was still one of the owners of Lonely Planet, they've been sort of courting me. And then when I had time on my hands after I sold out of Lonely Planet, I decided to join them. And they do archaeological projects in the developing world, but the bigger idea is that archaeology sites are great. You know, people get their PhDs for excavating it and writing about it and studying the history. But if it's going to be sustained, it needs local community involvement. You've got to have the guest houses and cafes and tour guides and bus drivers and all that employment that's created around an archaeology site really has to be a local engagement thing.
Turns out to be a great remunerative advantage, I mean, economically.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the idea, to make them realize, especially in some of these developing countries, how
absolutely
important. Yeah.
And it works. I mean, I've certainly seen that with my time with Global Heritage. And, of course, you know, I love it because I get to go to these countries and I get to not just visit the archaeological site, but very often visit with the archaeologist who's discovered it or excavated it. And it's fantastic. It really is.
I thought, you've been on the forum program through the years a number of times with me, I thought Tony Wheeler's probably traveled everywhere. And I was reading recently that you went to Ukraine and Panama and Sudan for the first time. But there are so many places you have not been, I was surprised to find out.
Yeah, I've got a long list. And, of course, some of them, yeah, I always say the one country I haven't been in the Arab world, and I'd love to go there at some point, but right now it's totally impossible, is the Yemen. The Yemen's always fascinated me, and we did have a Lonely Planet guide at one time.
It's not only impossible, but the Saudis and their group have put up a blockade, and this is not getting as much news attention as I believe it deserves, because it could create the worst famine that the world has ever seen, literally.
It could do that.
I mean, in modern times, yeah.
You know, and I my feeling, as soon as the Saudis set foot in there, I thought, well, this could be the Saudis' Vietnam. You know, it's one of those things, you get your foot into the sticky swamp, and it's hard to pull your foot out again.
Well, we don't have to get into politics this hour, but I keep wondering why Jared Kushner keeps going recently to Saudi Arabia, too, and what that bodes or what that tells us. But that's
there's a lot of money
for
there.
For another day, there is a lot of money there as well. But there's also a lot of terrible things that are being done in Yemen. What would be at the top of your list then, Yemen?
If I could just, you know,
maybe
say,
go to Yemen without the blockade.
Yeah, if you know, it was safe to visit there, and I don't mind visiting places that are a little bit unsafe, but I'm not risking my life. But yeah, if it was totally open, Yemen would be absolutely top of my list.
You were in Karabas recently?
I'm going there next week.
Yeah,
which, you know, better go soon, because if global warming does kick in, this could be one of the first countries to disappear beneath the waves.
Well, since you mentioned global warming, I was reading, I think it was a talk that you gave where you said there are too many planes and there are too many cars. And, of course, you're absolutely right. I mean, contributing to global warming.
Yeah, and I'm one of a person who drives around in them and rides in them. So I'm guilty, guilty, guilty.
Yeah, well, what do you say about the global warming problem, though? I mean, especially since there may be some places that are on the Lonely Planet list that aren't going to be there anymore.
Yeah, it is a big question, and you know, tourism is a two-sided thing. It does good things and it does bad things as well, and we have to balance the hope to, you know, make the good overpower the bad, as it were.
Well, I'm going to give the phone number, and I'm actually going to invite our listeners to talk about is there a place that you fantasized traveling to? And there are a lot of, by the way, Lonely Travel Books have a lot of quirky details. That's one of their signatures, you know, about going to these places that people love about them. Maybe some hear some stories as well. But really, if there's a trip that you've been fantasizing, pipe dreaming, I'm interested to know where in the world it is, so to speak. And maybe if you had a recent great trip, where did you go and what made it memorable to you? Let me open the phone lines and invite you to join our conversation with Tony Wheeler with those questions. And maybe one more I'll add. Tell us a spot that's still on your travel bucket list. Where is that, again, that you're longing to go to, which is really the first question I ask. Where do you fantasize? Where do you dream about going? But I put it in the bucket list context because a lot of people do see things that way. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786, and we welcome your involvement in the program. And Tony Wheeler will be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the World Affairs Auditorium in San Francisco, and you can see him there, but you can join us in conversation right now. Again, toll-free at 866-733-6786. A number of other ways you can join the program, and let me invite you to do those ways as well. If you prefer them, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us, or go to our Facebook page. Beth writes, does Tony Wheeler not understand the huge carbon footprint world travel has on our environment? I much prefer encouraging people to stay home and make their local habitat better.
Yeah, well, that's a good way, you know. The stay-home travel does have its merits as well. But on the other hand, then you're not putting money in those people's pockets in the developing world who really would like to have some tourists visiting them.
And Ben writes, before the internet age, I went all over Europe with my heavy Lonely Planet guide all over the continent. How has the digital age changed the way these guides are developed and featured? You kind of touched on that. Could you flesh it out a little
bit? Well, you know, there are all sorts of ways of getting travel information these days, and Lonely Planet's only one of the many ways that people do get travel information, from TripAdvisor to websites to all sorts of things. But you can get any Lonely Planet guide in digital form. And the trip I did across Asia earlier this year, I had about 20 Lonely Planet guides with me, all on one tablet.
We should mention that Lonely Planet has sold over 80 million books.
Over a lot more than that now, actually.
What are you up to?
We passed the 100 million mark a few years ago, and I think it's probably heading towards 150 million now.
Wow. largest travel publisher in the world.
I think they can probably claim that.
Yeah, I think indeed you can. So tell us, listeners, about the last great trip you took. Where'd you go? What made it memorable? Or tell us about a place you're still longing to go. And, of course, if you have questions for Tony Wheeler, or if you have some memories about Lonely Planet books that you took to different places, or the Lonely Planet story, we welcome your involvement in the program. And let's start with Gwen. Gwen, you're on.
Hi. I used to go to Europe, and I remember, I don't know, Tony, if you remember when everybody would go to the American Express office in Paris and would try to get a ride with the people that held signs up there. And, you know, I got a ride to Spain in a Mercedes diesel. And I enjoy your books because, like, you give history. Like, I used to go to Guatemala a lot before it got kind of dicey, and I would stay at the Pension Mesa, and I read in Your Lonely Planet that the owner used to hang out with Che Guevara, and Che Guevara, you know, would stay there. And my other comment is, like, I found you get the off the beaten tracks. Like, I found this place called Finca Tetén, which is near Livingston. In fact, you have to go to Livingston in Guatemala, and you take two boats up to this place. And there's no, it's right dead on the river, and, you know, it's where God lives. There's no internet, and, you know, it's an honest sign-in thing. In fact, one time the owner, he had to go into Rio Dulce to change dollars, and he told me, Carmen, you're in charge. And he just took off, and he was gone a week, and I had to sign people in, give the cook the money for the, you know, the meals, and then we became friends. I don't know if that place still exists. It's called Finca Tetén. But I really enjoy your book. My last statement is my bucket list is I'm going to fly into Panama because Copa flies backwards anyway, and then I want to see those boats go up and down, and then I'm taking the bus to Costa Rica, where for the past 10 years I've been going every year. And that's my comment.
All right. Thank you for those comments, Gwen. Good to hear from you. It's rewarding, isn't it, to hear how much these books enrich people's travels?
Yeah, absolutely is. And I really like the idea of Panama. One of the things I discovered when I was there last year is I went out with a bird watcher, and he said, this is the place for bird watching. The Andes comes up from South America and ends at the Panama Canal. The Rockies come down from North America and end at the Panama Canal. So you get birds from both continents. He said it's one of the best places for bird watching in the world.
Well, you get, in fact, I'm looking at a comment here from a listener named Joe Ellen. Says, I'm heading for Thailand on a bat research trip next week. It's my first trip to Asia. People go to see birds, they go to learn about bats. I mean, it's fascinating what the magnets are. And when she said, she mentioned God, you know, I remember a high school friend of mine coming out here a number of years ago, and I took him up to Mount Tamalpais, and he said, I never heard this phrase before. God left his bedroom slippers here. It just brings to mind that you've been so many places, you've seen so many things. When you think about awe, when you think about, you know, that kind of extraordinary almost reverence that you have from certain things that you see, what comes immediately to your mind?
I always think of the Himalaya, you know. Yeah. You get up at some place in the Himalaya in Nepal, and, you know, you may not be seeing Mount Everest just there, but, you know, it's just down the road a little way. And the sun comes up behind the mountains, and it gets a bit warmer. Thank God. And, you know, that's magic. That's always magic.
Well, I was thinking about, you know, what are the most beautiful places I've seen other than, you know, our own Northern California? And Bariloche comes to mind, especially standing atop there, and New Zealand.
Yeah, New Zealand, there's a lot of beauty in New Zealand.
Extraordinary beauty. And we'll get some more callers on here. Let me get Mike on next. Mike, you're on.
Well, thanks for the the recommendation for New Zealand. We're going there for New Year's Eve this year.
But
my first comment was thank you for the books. I did 28 countries on a motorcycle throughout Europe with just your book in my hand way back before the internet. And so wonderful asset, and, you know, thank you for that.
It was just one book, not 28 books?
No. I had used a number of different books and kind of traded them throughout the youth hostels that I went to, and was able to kind of move up to the next one by the different hostel in a different country. So it was a really, really a fun experience. But I'm on my 64th country right now, and I really cannot express enough to people to go to Cuba, go to Bali, and go to Argentina. Such an amazing place, Argentina.
Yeah, I mentioned Bariloche, and Cuba's also a beautiful place to visit.
Yeah, I've been to Cuba a few times over the years, and it's been remarkable how it's changed in the last 15 years. You know, it's much more open these days. The food has improved dramatically. I've had some really good times in Cuba.
There's so much life out in the streets and
absolutely.
Art
and music. You know, and the music is around
wonderful.
You all the time.
But it's also terrible poverty. I mean, you realize that when you're there, especially in Havana.
Yeah.
Let me thank the caller. And we're going to continue actually taking your calls and finding out where places are that you want to go. You can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and tell us about the last great trip you took, and let's get Eli on. Eli, welcome.
Tony, I just wanted to thank you. I took a trip in 1998, and like the other caller, all I had with me was a Lonely Planet. And interesting historical thing, that was the first time I ever heard of an internet cafe. We were in Bangkok and said we should go to this place called the Internet Cafe, and that's how we learned how to communicate with our family back home, because back then in 1998 it was kind of just coming around, and you know, you'd go to a little place in the Khao San Road in Bangkok and do this thing called emailing, where you would electronically mail your family back home and didn't have to send letters. But anyway, in a roundabout way, that led us to a little island off of Malaysia that we found in your book called Penang. And in Penang, I met a guy, I think a lot like you, who had ridden his motorcycle from London all the way across Asia. And so he seemed like the perfect person to ask, you know, where if you could go anywhere in the world, where would you go? And I still have not done it. It's on my list. But he said that the number one trip he ever took was to Mongolia. And he went to Mongolia, and he bought a horse and went with a guide and rode out into the plains.
And was it a regular horse? Because they're known for their miniature horses in Mongolia.
Yeah, you know, I've not gone, but that's me and my buddies have a that's on our list of one of our you know, have to do trips, to go to Mongolia and ride a horse in the plains. And I don't know if you know, if riding a horse is in there, but I'm just wondering if Tony's ever been there and if he would suggest any suggestions for going to Mongolia.
Yeah, I have been to Mongolia, and I must admit I didn't ride a horse across Mongolia. I've been across Mongolia by train, joining the Trans-Siberian Express. And I've also traveled around by bus and car and jeep, and at one stage on old Russian helicopters going out to a place in the desert, because it's one of the best places in the world for people to look for dinosaur skeletons. The museum in Ulaanbaatar, the capital, has some amazing dinosaur skeletons. Mongolia can be tough travel, but it's an interesting place to go.
What's the toughest travel that you found?
Oh, I think if I didn't, you know, have the helicopter in the background, it could well have been Mongolia. Mongolia was tough. I think any time you get stuck somewhere, and I've had places in the Pacific where you're just waiting for that next ship to come, and you think, I can't stand a few more days here. I just hope that boat turns up.
We used to talk about Outer Mongolia, remember? As kids,
absolutely.
We said, like it was Siberia. More with Tony Wheeler when we return. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Tony Wheeler, the co-founder of Lonely Planet and Lonely Planet Guidebooks. He's also a trustee with the Global Heritage Fund, which aims at preserving archaeological sites around the world. And we're talking a little bit during that break about, I asked Tony about the most hospitable place he's been, and he said Uzbekistan.
You wouldn't believe it, would you? But we drove through 19 countries earlier this year with myself and some friends, and we started in Bangkok, we ended up in London, we went up through Southeast Asia, across China, through four of the five stands, through Iran, through Turkey, and into Europe. And we all agreed at the end that the friendliest place was Uzbekistan. And Who would believe it?
Yeah, well, you know, we've seen that a lot in the news lately because of the terrorism in New York. The man who fought for ISIS and decided to kill people, innocent people, was from Uzbekistan.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah. There's a tweet from Trevor who says, I'd love to hear your guest thoughts on over-tourism and loving these places to death. Are you about Barcelona here?
Barcelona is definitely one of the places where this has been highlighted recently. There's lots of destinations in the world where we just have too many visitors, and how do you handle them all? It's not like Disneyland that you can say places fill up, we're not going to be issuing any more tickets today. But there are certainly destinations in the world where we may well have too many visitors.
And we'll have more visitors by phone. We'll go next to you, Faye. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, sure thing. Ironically, yes, I'm originally from Hawaii, although I've lived here for about 34 years, and that's some parts are over-visited, but there is one island that is closed off to visitors and is owned by the Robinson family. It's called Ni'ihau. And, Tony, I'm just wondering if you have any information about that, if people can go. Some of the residents are airlifted out, I guess, to work, but I'm not sure if that's still going on.
I must admit I'd have to get the Lonely Planet Hawaii guide out and start looking it up because I'm not familiar with that place at all. But it sounds fascinating.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Have you been to Lanai or to Kauai?
Now, do you know, my travel in Hawaii has been very limited. I've been there a couple of times, but it's another of those places on the bucket list that I have to go there and do some serious travel at some point.
You know, there are people, I think we've heard from a couple of them just this morning, who collect countries. I mean,
absolutely.
It's like notches on a whatever.
100%. I've got a few friends who've really made a task on visiting every country on Earth, and they've put a tick beside every single box.
Has your guest Ben wants to know, to the ancient Greek cities in Syria? The pictures of Palmyra and Aleppo pre-war are amazing. Seeing these Hellenistic monuments in real life would be breathtaking.
Syria, I've only been there once, and it was some years ago, but I was just knocked out by it. It's a wonderful place, and it's just a tragedy how the damage that's been done and the fact that we can't go there. And, of course, it's much more. It's the Roman ruins, but it's also Crusader castles. It's also early Christian centers. It's wonderful mosques. You can, in Damascus, if you could go to Damascus, you can walk down the biblical street named Straight. And I think that's just fantastic to be able to go there and say, well, here I am being led around by the Bible.
I think one of the most tragic things in conjunction with the Global Heritage Fund and the work that you've been doing, and the Global Heritage Fund has been doing, I know, some really good work, to put it mildly, is these great archaeological sites that have been destroyed by ISIS, for example,
yeah,
or by the Taliban. I mean,
well, the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan,
that's
the greatest regret of my life, that I went to Afghanistan and didn't go up to Bamiyan. I have been back to Bamiyan, but it was after the Taliban had destroyed the Buddhas.
This is Adam who says, I've always been fascinated by the vastness of Russia, and I love train trips. Consequently, I'd love to take the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Do I go on the cushy and expensive charter trains seemingly aimed mostly at British retirees, or do I go on the local trains?
It depends on your ability to put up with hardship, because the local train, you know, you're... it's not going to be as comfortable at all. On the other hand, you know, you do a day or so, get off, wait for the next train, and, you know, carry on that way. So you can mix it up. I've done the Trans-Siberian once, and I've got to admit I did it the cushy way.
Let me bring some more callers on, and we'll go next to you, Kevin. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I've had some fun trips in my life, including the Galapagos Islands, where they regulate the number of people that can visit there. I've been to China, and Thailand was lots of fun, and my last big trip 9 years ago was to Europe, where I spent almost 3 months before moving here, relocating from Chicago. And went, you know, to England and Belgium, and Bruges was beautiful, and France and Spain, and particularly Italy, where I spent 45 days.
There's a very funny movie about Bruges, by the
way. There is indeed.
I think Tony and I were thinking alike.
Yeah,
that's what motivated that location. But my question, and at the top of my bucket list, is I would love to see the largest concentration of animals still living in their natural habitat in Africa. What country would you suggest? And, you know, with rhinos and elephants in high demand, at least their horns and tusks, in China and other places, they're disappearing. 95 elephants a day are being slaughtered. So what would you say is the country with the highest concentration of animals that you can see in their natural habitat?
That's a good question. And I've been to Africa a few times. You know, and the first time I went to Africa, it was some years ago when my kids were quite small, and I took my kids there. And they loved it. The tougher it was, the more they loved it. You know, we stayed in some fancy game lodges where you could sit in your room and sort of look out the window at the animals, and that was fine. But they much preferred to be out there camping out, you know, and at night hearing the noises come in through the canvas of your tent. That was much more up their alley. And that trip, we did some travel around Kenya, and Kenya is sort of the first stop. You know, it's easiest to go there. Game safaris are really well organized there, but Tanzania is really good. The last time I've done that sort of thing has been in Tanzania, Botswana and Namibia, and South Africa. You know, there's a bunch of different places that are good. Tanzania, perhaps. Maybe I'll recommend
Tanzania. Yeah, I was thinking
Tanzania,
the Serengeti Plain.
Yeah, absolutely.
And here's Ginny who writes, my husband and I quit our jobs in 1990 and headed to Kenya with a Lonely Planet guidebook. There was one line mentioning a company in Nairobi that rented Jeeps equipped for camping. I convinced my husband that we should stretch our budget and do it. It was a life-changing experience for us. We did a self-drive safari in Tanzania in 2014, and we're planning for Namibia next year.
Absolutely.
I had to ask you, your book's still out, Badlands?
Yeah.
Tourists on the Axis of Evil?
Yeah, I always say that George Bush made me write that book, because as soon as he said there are three countries which are so bad that they constitute an axis of evil, my first thought was, well, I want to go there, which I did, and added some other bad countries to the list to write that book.
And what about your trip to North Korea? I mean, yeah. It's like visiting another planet, literally, isn't it?
You know, you often felt like you were on some Hollywood movie set, and you sort of thought this is all fake, and if you walk around behind the building, you're going to find that it's been propped up, which is why I don't really worry too much about the North Koreans. They wave their arms around, or whoever the current leader is, whichever Kim it is in control.
Kim Jong Un.
That's the current one. Yes, you know, they waves his arms around and shouts a lot, but I don't really think he's going to be able to do things if it came to the crunch.
Well, that axis of evil also included Iraq and Iran, and our next caller wants to mention Iran. Pam, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Tony, I want to thank you very much for being on the show, but most of all to thank you because I think I have a bookcase filled with the Lonely Planet guides. I've been to 73 countries since 2001, and so I have a record here in terms of that. But we just returned from Iran last week. And I'm not an Iranian-American, but I went because I was curious, and I wanted to see for myself and to prove that we travel so that we get to know the people and that we understand the culture and we don't let politics or the government get in the way.
Can I ask, Pam, because I know people who have done what you did were not Iranians or Iranian-Americans and who came away with very positive feelings about the people of Iran. Did you feel that?
Oh, actually, I almost wanted. I was like a movie star in Iran. When people would ask us, where are you from? There aren't very many Americans who go there. And so as soon as we would say we were from America, they just smiled at us and some people hugged us even, and everybody wanted to take a selfie with us.
Yeah.
And then people wanted to tell us about their feelings for America. And, you know, honestly, over the years, I've traveled to places where I tried to pass myself off as Canadian. But I have to say that I was really proud to be an American traveling in Iran, mainly because I felt so welcome there. They love us. They remember when we were there before the revolution.
They don't love the country. Remember, the Ayatollahs have called us the Great Satan pretty consistently.
Right. No, they just love us, and they're so grateful for us to come there. I've never met, and I'm serious when I say they really are the most hospitable people, other than the Irish, I've met. I was invited to so many homes for dinner. I had many, many conversations. People are what I'm interested in. They have a tribal culture there as well, which I think some people don't know. And by tribal, I mean nomadic. There's a group of people called the Qashqai, and they live in the south. And they are, well, by nomadic, they transport their goats and sheep by truck now from the lowlands to the highlands, depending on the season. But people don't realize what I think Iran has to offer by way of history. I mean, the architecture and the art is just phenomenal. And we also bought a couple of Persian rugs.
Oh, Pam, you've just,
you do, yes.
You've just done some good advance work for the Iranian tourism.
Yeah. I've got to agree that, you know, I've been in Iran this year as well, and they are extraordinarily friendly people. And I guess it's one of these countries that, you know, they're not over-touristed. They'd really like to be a little more over-touristed. They'd like more tourists to come. And as a result, you get a really warm welcome.
They're Persians, and, you know, by nature, the culture has always been hospitable and warm.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Let me bring in more calls, and let's go next to Roger. Roger, you're on.
Yes, thank you. I have a rather large bookcase of travel in my life. I'll give you an example of two extremes. My first trip to Europe was shortly after I got out of the Marine Corps. I traveled throughout Europe with a pack, small pack, with an American flag on it, hitchhiked everywhere. People were wonderful. In 1995, I flew on the Concorde from New York to Paris. Now, the one thing I know about travel is that it breaks down racism. It breaks down preconceived ideas that you have about people. Most people, I think all people in the world, are basically very friendly, very kind. I had an experience here in San Francisco. I'm getting up in years now. I'm heading towards 79. My brain is still young, but my body is starting to show the scars of
too much travel.
A lot of travel. Anyway, I was down in Fisherman Wharf, and I thought I could jump over this chain. It was just a small chain. Well, I didn't make it, and I tripped. And a whole bunch of foreign tourists, They didn't even speak English, but their instincts was to rush to me and help me up from the ground. And it just shows you, at least it's confirmed my belief, that people are kind. Travel is so healthy. I would encourage parents out there listening who have children, encourage their children to travel.
See if you can jump over something in New York and fall like that, and people will come to your aid and your side.
Oh, that's a very Californian view of New York we're hearing there.
Actually, I'm a fan of New York and New Yorkers. Roger, thank you for that. Nice, optimistic view of people all over the world. You share that, Tony Miller?
I absolutely do. I mean, that's the thing about travel. It is how you meet people. You know, these people are not just words and names in newspapers or on the television. When you go there, like the lady going to Iran, you know, you find out just how warm people are. Or they can be in San Francisco if you trip over the chain.
So those are the foreigners, not the San Franciscans who helped them. Here's Jessica. Jessica, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Well, this is such an interesting show. I'm really enjoying it. But I was calling because, of course, I love to travel. And to me, one of the most important things, or what I like best about traveling, is meeting people, meeting local people and people who live there, and not just seeing the sights. And I came across this company called the Freebird Club, and it's kind of like an Airbnb, but for people over 50. And when we just returned from Ireland, and we stayed with a gentleman who was a host, and we lived in this house for a few days. And he took us around, and he showed us his favorite restaurant and the pub. And if it hadn't rained, we would have gone golfing. And I just thought it was just a great way of traveling. And I'm hoping to do more of that. And I'm also hoping to be – I'd like to be a Freebird Club host so I can have people from other countries or even other parts of the United States stay in my home as well. Because to me, I don't know, the personal experience of actually living in somebody's home is just – what makes the trip, I think, really special.
Well said.
So, yeah.
Thank you for that, Jessica. Good to hear from you. Appreciate your calling. And Let me go to some comments here. Colleen writes, I'm longing to go to Antarctica, but what are the ethics of traveling there? Is it too damaging to the environment?
Look, Antarctica has become enormously popular. And one of the things about going down to Antarctica is people think, you know, this is something it's the final tick on the list. I've gone to Antarctica and I've been everywhere. And a remarkable number of people find they go down to Antarctica and having gone once, they want to go again. They've been down to see the seals and the penguins on the Antarctic Peninsula, for example, and then they think, no, I want to go around the other side and see where the explorers set off when they were making their way down to the South Pole. So there, it has attractions that bring people back. And I don't think, you know, there's been a lot more damage done by some of the scientific bases there, who haven't always been as scientific as they should be, than the tourists. I think the thing to do, though, if you go to Antarctica, is to make sure you go on a small boat. The smaller the boat, the better it's going to be.
There's a lot of gear that you have to put on when you're there, right?
You only go down in summer, of course. You know, it's the time of year when the sun never sets. It's light all the time. And it's not always as cold as you think. I've actually done a walking trip in Antarctica where we were camping out at night in the snow, and that was cold, but
I just have this image of I had friends who were there recently, and they were on a boat, but they had all this gear, rubber gear, and everything.
Yeah,
a lot of it's safety on the boat too.
You don't want to fall out in the water.
Right.
People go scuba diving in Antarctica, so you can do anything.
They say the best scuba diving is in Bali.
Well, I've been there. There is good diving there. I think there's probably some places in the Pacific that I'd put ahead of that, but yeah, there's. Scuba diving is one of those things you never have a bad scuba dive. Well, I've been scuba diving at Monterey, and I've had a cold scuba dive. That's about as cold as I want to do it.
Here's a tweet from a listener. This puts a heavy responsibility perhaps on you as the font of wisdom here, but she wants to know, as a single female, she wants a backpack across Southeast Asia. Is this advisable?
No problem at all. I think, you know, traveling as a woman, you have to... There are additional things you have to be careful about, but what everyone's been saying, you know, that wherever you go, people are generally welcoming.
And we'll welcome another caller, and Mark, that's you. Join us.
Oh, hello, hi. Yeah, I went to Europe in 2011, and I'm afraid to fly, so I booked passage on a cargo container vessel to cross the Atlantic, and I leased a car for 7 months and camped in a pup tent to... you know, economize, and it was a grand way of meeting people at campgrounds, and the campgrounds are really quite sophisticated these days. You know, they got showers. It varies. Some are pretty minimal, but it was a wonderful way to do Europe, I thought.
What an interesting and unique way to travel. Mark, thank you for that.
I think the container ship idea, I've not done that, but increasingly container ships are taking just a small number of passengers. It used to be for a long time they just wouldn't take passengers at all. But I think that'd be a great way to go.
And here's Peter. Peter, join us. Welcome.
Good morning. I did not travel by container ship in my 20s. I was in the Navy, and I went everywhere by submarine, which I don't recommend particularly, but it was a very interesting way to get myself across Asia. And it's almost difficult to remember how amazing those adventures were. You were working along the way, but I've been up under the Arctic ice and broken through. I've been through the Panama Canal, traveled extensively through Asia, and there was one particular trip that I wanted to remark upon. I think it's late summer or early fall. They do the fire festival at Mount Fuji in Japan, and that was an amazing experience, just to immerse myself in the Japanese culture and the traditional experience there. And I was wondering if you'd ever been to the fire festival at Mount Fuji.
No, I have not. And that sounds definitely worth doing. But I have climbed Mount Fuji, and it's one of those mountains, you know, Japanese feel that life isn't complete unless you climb Fuji at least once. Although they say you're a wise man if you climb Fuji once, you're a fool if you do it more than once.
And let me thank you, Peter. You're getting some wonderful memories here and of travel and thoughts about where people would love to travel. Catherine writes, though, in these times, anxiety runs high. How does one overcome the fear of losing control over their environment and circumstances somewhat requisite for travel?
Well, I think, you know, what people have been saying all the way through this program today is that people in general are friendly and that, you know, it's wise to be careful, but things can go wrong on your own front doorstep. You don't have to go across the other side of the world for things not to work out.
And a comment from Don, who says, in the 80s, I did tourism consulting for the state of Oregon. We advocated the idea of healthy tourism, working to create jobs, income, and tax revenue without jeopardizing the local quality of life. This meant promoting and sharing places like local museums, gardens, historic spots, while protecting local favorites like fishing holes among the Willamette. This can work in newly discovered places, but not known destinations like Hawaii. Let me bring another caller on here, and that's you, Joanne. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. First of all, I just want to say I recently came back from a trip in Uzbekistan, and I highly recommend it. The people are friendly, very colorful, and the architectural history is really phenomenal in terms of understanding the whole history of the world in Central Asia and also the Soviet Union imprint on the Central Stance. My question is, with the increasing political situation in China, in Western China for Xinjiang, on my bucket list has always been Kashgar. And I understand that they've torn down the old city and reconstructed it. And wondered, you know, what is the best way to travel to Kashgar and throughout Xinjiang?
Yeah, I traveled a little bit through Xinjiang province this year, and not through Kashgar. But I went to Kashgar about 4 years ago. Maureen, my wife and I, we traveled up from Pakistan, up the Karakoram Highway, which essentially sort of takes you over the top of the Himalaya and then down. And sadly, Kashgar is not what it was 10 or 20 years ago. And friends of mine who've been there earlier on, you know, their descriptions of what it used to be like until the Chinese took it over and did their work on it, it's a very sad story, because it's still a magical name. It's one of those places like, you know, Marrakesh and Timbuktu and Kathmandu. Kashgar, you know, it just sounds magic. It's definitely a place to go for that reason. But sadly, the city itself is not what it once was.
I thank the caller and remind you we're talking to Tony Wheeler, who is co-founder of Lonely Planet Travel Guidebooks and trustee with the Global Heritage Fund. And he's speaking tonight, 6:30 at the World Affairs Auditorium in San Francisco. And let's go to another caller, and that's you, Kathleen. You're on the air.
Hi. I was an unknowing and uneducated Peace Corps volunteer in the late 60s. And I was lucky enough to go to West Africa, to Sierra Leone, which has a really sad kind of recent past. But I find that everywhere I went in West Africa was just glorious in terms of meeting people and having the opportunity to travel. I can remember a trip on a peanut truck, sitting on top of the peanuts and going all the way up toward Upper Volta. So I'd like to return to West Africa. You know, there's Benin, a new country. There's Togo, and I've never been to Nigeria. I'm particularly interested in service trips, a trip to go on to do something, also to leave something for the people that you're meeting. And I wonder if you have any suggestions.
I think what you're doing is great, and I've been a little bit around West Africa, but my daughter has actually traveled far more extensively around West Africa than I have. One of the things Maureen and I did after we sold Lonely Planet, we used to have a foundation within the company, and we took that out and set it up as our own foundation. We called it Planet Wheeler. And my daughter Tashi helps to run that, and she does a lot of travel in West Africa looking at projects that we have going on there. And I know she's been to Sierra Leone, and I was checking into a hotel with her recently, and she gave me her passport to hand over, and I sort of flipped it open, and I was looking at it and thinking, how come she's been to all these places? She's way ahead of me. So yeah, I think West Africa would be an interesting place, and it is a region that does need a lot of help in a lot of countries. So if you can find good things to do there.
And fantastic. Thank you for the call. There's concern, of course, about traveling in Nigeria now because of Boko Haram.
Which is in one area of Nigeria. Yeah. But Nigeria would be a tough travel place anyway.
Where did your daughter get the name Tashi?
Tashi, it's a Tibetan name.
Yeah,
we got it because my wife was pregnant while we were in Ladakh in the Tibetan region of North India, and we just met so many really pleasant, really fun people called Tashi. It's a male or female name, And we thought, oh, if we have a, we saw it as a female name, I must admit. But if we have a daughter, we'll call her Tashi, and we did.
It's also a name in a of a obscure Melville small novel, I believe, but different spelling. Here's Tom, who writes, I'm someone who likes to visit museums, theater, and antiquities, most often found in the traditional tourist destinations like Rome, Paris, and London. Do you have any tips for me on how to make those visits less hectic, even in the fall? These places are overrun with tourists.
They are, but one of the things is that they're very often secondary museums that you that aren't the big ones. And I live in London part of each year. And, of course, everybody goes to the British Museum and goes to the Victoria and Albert. But there's a whole bunch of, you know, smaller museums that just don't get the same crowds at all. And if you search some of those out, you'll enjoy them because they're less crowded, but you'll also see things that you wouldn't have found in the big museums.
Kristen writes, are there places you suggest visiting while one is healthy and hearty? For instance, I'm thinking India might be pretty challenging, but I could wait on the U.S. national parks. I'll put a plug in for the national parks, by the way. I mean, well, people love to travel abroad, but they are so magnificent, and they're right here.
They certainly are, but of course you need to be healthy for some of them, don't you?
Yes, you do.
You're out there walking.
Vigorous, and hope that you don't take
pills. Whereas you can sit back in luxury in India, as long as the food's good.
Erica writes, I just got surprise tickets to Barcelona for spring break with two teenage boys. Any recommendations about what we should absolutely not miss?
Well, you've got to see the Gaudi architecture when you're there. That's, of course, the number one.
That's one of the major highlights, yeah.
And, of course, the other thing about anywhere in Spain is you have to get used to eating late at night. You know, you go to a restaurant at 9 o'clock and they say, 9 o'clock, we're not even open yet. Come back in half an hour.
Tony Wheeler, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
And you can actually hear and meet Tony Wheeler tonight. He'll be speaking 6:30 at the World Affairs Council Auditorium in San Francisco. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineers, Danny Bringer. Our engagement producers are Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Anna Sterla and Patrick Fitzgerald. Managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for joining us. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.